ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Christopher Skase, young, handsome, entrepreneur. He finds epic success in the 80s.
He came with that cowboy energy. He was doing big things.
Skase becomes a media mogul.
He outbid the legendary Rupert Murdoch.
His empire teeters, but he outfoxes them all. I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National, on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you're listening to us. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is where we talk books, review them, wrestle with the ideas they contain and, well, generally come to some kind of peaceful concord about them.
Cassie, it's also really interesting to see what happens when we put the books we've selected together. Today, for example, there's a sort of surprising Venn diagram of ideas because we've got three books. Two of them touch on true crime. Another two use autofiction as a sort of plot point, or the whole idea of it comes under scrutiny.
Australian writer Madeleine Gray, she of Green Dot, international acclaim for that incredible novel. Her second novel is called Chosen Family. I'm told it's about friendship and love and family and coming of age. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that.
And also the American writer Chris Krauss. She wrote what's being described as a cult novel, I Love Dick. We're going to talk about her ninth book, The Four Spent the Day Together.
It's just funny hearing you say that, Kate. But first to the Outer Hebrides off the coast of Scotland and, well, a tiny island called Benbecula.
Graham McRae Burnett is a Scottish writer whose work we've discussed here on The Bookshelf before, Cassie.
Yes, he's quite nutty. I think of him as a want-to-be psychiatrist. He's got a dark twist in his mind, or at least a fascination for a dark twist.
Yes, well, his second novel, His Bloody Project, well, the title suggests that he's interested in blood and violence. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 2016, and it was the story of a 19th century murder, a preoccupation that, well, we're going to return to.
Mm. And then there was Case Study, which I particularly liked because it was about this nutty young woman and her psychiatrist. But what was it really about? Quite a twist in that one.
And then he's also written a series of crime novels, including A Case of Matricide. And again, he's sort of playing with crime fiction and what it does and how narrative works. I mean, he's a thoughtful writer, I think.
Well, now his latest, Benbecula, is here. Benbecula is this tiny little island off the northwest coast of Scotland. To the north, next stop, Iceland. To the west, Alaska. It's chilly, it's isolated, and it has a very ancient history.
And the sort of sense of this flat, dark, strange landscape, but... Well, Cassie, the beginning of this novel, why don't you take us right into it? Because it sets up so many things. That's so arresting.
Okay. Well, let's just begin at the very beginning. This is a classic opening to a novel, I think. My name is Malcolm McPhee. If you're wondering why it falls to me to tell this tale, it is for no other reason than this. I am the only one left. Since the incidents I am about to recount, my sister Marion and my brother John have also departed this place. I did not want them to go, but nor could I blame them for wishing to leave. There is nothing here for our generation. Our way of life is dying, but for the McPhees of Linaclate, it came to a more abrupt end than most. This, for on the 9th day of July, 1857, my brother Angus did to death my father, my mother, and my aunt, all in the most brutal and purposeful fashion.
What a powerful opening, because it takes us into the place, into the family, into this terrible story that he is the only one left telling us about what his brother did, but also that idea, there's nothing left here for our generation. So quickly we've got both the murder and its repercussion, and it feels like this novel keeps moving in and out of both the violence of the murder and the stain and the stench that it's left behind.
Yeah, the murders, the three deaths, his father, mother and aunt by his brother. And in these sentences, you know, we learn so much from so little. It's very intimate but very formal. Departed this place, as if the earth is just one of many places one could find oneself. And the question, did they choose to leave this place, or did they end their lives, or something else? There's a lot of mystery, grim mystery, in this dread-filled little paragraph. And there's also these archaisms in his turn of phrase, which quickly are confirmed by the date, 1857, and our generation, our way of life. You know, they're the endlings of this once presumably thriving community, or at least surviving community, and this abrupt end, even that sentence, you know, there's this implied sense of massive violence, which is magnified somehow by the restraint of the language. It's just conveys dread.
And keeps on building on that in the next few paragraphs, in this land that's flat and sodden, this sense of these constrained lives and the work that they've done and the crops that they've grown. But then it shifts a bit, so we get the sense that even within this small community, there was something odd about this family that is described at one point as holding on like limpets to this land, where they refused to leave, but then they don't quite belong there either.
Yes, because, you know, this is a far-flung place and there are a few people on the island itself, and, you know, the little series of islands around it, you know, just the same small little communities. So to be outcasts in a place of outcasts really means they're at the end of the earth. The formal language that Malcolm McPhee, the character, uses in this voice, he's the narrator, it's a little at odds with what we learn about the family as the story unfolds. And that is that they're very ill-educated. They have some appalling standards of living, cleanliness. No one really seems to bathe. The mother, there's four children actually, the mother sits by the fire most of the day and tends to it with her poking stick and doesn't want anyone else to touch it or put any other fuel on it. But she sort of sits there with her legs wide open as if sort of warming herself. Very strange image. The father, I mean, he's similarly kind of remote and distant and feral.
And the way that they're described, there's a sense that these people are not handsome, they're not attractive. And that's something that Malcolm is aware of, that nobody quite wants to look at them properly, even before these terrible events and the things that happened to his brother. And very quickly, like within a couple of pages of the book, we see how that past history has somehow been tainted by these murders. It's the smell of the murders and the rumours, and it's changed him. I mean, as a narrator, we're told he's only in his early 30s. But he feels like a much older character because he's not engaging with the community. Somebody comes in and makes him wash and brings him food. And the children around the place are scared of him and come to look at him and to look at him in his skull house. And the skull house is both his mind and the little hovel that he lives in.
Well, the family home is where he's living and where he's recounting this tale. And it takes a long time for events to unfold before the deaths of his mother, father and aunt. But yes, that way he describes sitting in this landscape, in this house, he says, "I sometimes fancy this house as a skull and myself as the brain contained within it. The two windows are the eyes and the door is the nasal cavity. It is, you understand, a skull half buried in the earth. The thatch is the hair. You might object that a skull has no hair, but you would be wrong. The worms dispose of the flesh in short order, but they have no taste for the hair. Indeed, I have heard that the hair continues to grow after death, so my skull house with its thatch of hair is quite credible." Now, how does he know that? About skulls. Anyway, that's something the reader can get to themselves. But what's clearly happening within this household is a sort of breakdown of the very lowest. They're operating at the lowest order, but that's broken down. So all they do is drink whiskey, eat potatoes. That is really their only food source. And they all seem to manage to have an easy supply of tobacco, which they smoke out of little pipes. Or sometimes they just pass a pipe between each other, but they're doing that all day long. They don't wash. They seem to just sleep, well, wherever they want. There's a toilet in a wooden box. The aunt has a separate dwelling, but that's just a little, well, it's a hut, but it's just a place where she sleeps. And then she sort of shuffles into the house. The son, Angus, is the real problem. Now, he's much smaller than the other siblings and he's the apple of his mother's eye, but he's got a very problematic personality. I mean, he actually sounds deranged or at least to have some serious cognitive impairment.
Yes, and they describe moments of what we might describe as psychosis and rages, and he doesn't even always remember what he's done, but he has to be restrained or tied up or sort of sat on because he just totally and utterly loses it.
He's violent, and he thinks the violence is funny as well. Yeah.
And Malcolm also thinks that he's sort of making up some of these actions and he's using it so as not to work, because they both work the land and they go out and they collect seaweed, which is never called seaweed. It's always called seaware, and they burn it. So there's a sense of the smell of this place,
which is real subsistence living, because the labour of doing that takes all day, but it only merely just replaces what was lost. There's no growth in their income at all. And I was really pleased to have my Chambers Dictionary by my side as I was reading this, the Scottish Dictionary, because it is full of lots of archaisms of Scottish origin, which are just fabulous. It's such a nutty language. So there is this community around them, as we've said, and it's apparent that they are worried and they send people to the household to try and contain Angus's behaviour. I mean, he's also incredibly sexually uninhibited, Angus, so he goes around masturbating everywhere and trying to, you know, he's just quite revolting. You know, there's incidences at church and in the village, and they want to come and take him and send him to a lunatic asylum. And the family says, well, we haven't got any money, we're not going to pay for that. And they said, well, the parish will pay, you know, we'll pay to get rid of him.
And that's quite an interesting one, because there's a sense that, like, we see them as terribly poor, but the community and the people in power say, well, you would have to pay something to the upkeep. And they get furious at the idea that, like, they don't want to be labelled as poor, but they also say we can't afford to look after him. And at one point his sister, Malcolm's sister, spits on the person who's there to...
She coughs up this giant ball of phlegm and just sort of spits it at the lawman of the little village.
The inspector of the poor.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And so there's this sense of a sort of resistance to authority and to any sort of oversight, and also a resistance to asking what's happening. And so Malcolm, our narrator, says, I never thought to ask Angus, the brother, why he did these things. Because at one point, Angus goes across this sort of causeway at low tide and he rings the bells of the church, and it's this terribly disruptive thing. And Malcolm reflects afterwards, there was a real intent to that, and I never asked him why. And nobody ever seems to be saying, what's going on here?
So I think there's a little suggestion of these kids being the product of incest. There does seem to be some sort of genetic issue with the way they are physically. Anyway, I don't think we should reveal far too much more about what has happened and what happens and unfolds in this story, because it is the mystery that drags you through very quickly. But Benbecula is about an actual case. And at the end, in an afterword, which is quite extensive and detailed, we get the outlines of a story that Graham McRae Burnett has found or knew of and researched in the archives, which to some degree matches up with the events he describes, though he has taken license with it.
And it also shows his preoccupations, because there is a character who is involved in the real story of this character, Angus, who appeared in his Bloody Project, which was in Burnett's second novel. So he's very interested in this history of violence, histories of insanity, and how to take moments from the past and use them in fiction. I don't even know whether I should say I love the voice of this book. I was so arrested by the voice of this book. And because it's in first person, you then start to interrogate that voice in such powerful ways of why is he telling this story and what does it mean that we're listening to it from this brother?
I have a quibble about that, but I can't really describe it in detail because it's too much of a spoiler. But at some point I think the narrative becomes uncertain, and I wondered whether that landed exactly as intended. But I'll leave it to readers to discover it, because it is a kind of scary, chilly, dark, foul tale.
Yes, it makes you want to use all of those words. I started to list some of those words. And that's Graham McRae Burnett's Benbecula, published by Text. Now on the bookshelf here on ABC Radio National, let's meet this week's guests. Nicola Heath is an ABC arts journalist, and Patrick Carey is a writer and content maker who works at Sydney Theatre Company. Hello to both of you.
Hello, my dear friends. It's good to see you again.
Yeah, lovely to see you back. And Nicola, lovely to have you here. We work with you all the time because you write about books for ABC Radio National's website and the ABC website. You've got the best books of the year column coming up. No stress.
We do. It's coming up in December. So it's sort of the big finale of the series of best book columns that we run throughout the year. It's a monthly column. And of course, both Kate and Cassie, you contribute, which we really appreciate. But yeah, it's very exciting. People love a long list, as we've just established with the top 100 books. Yes. So we can indulge that desire again.
Patrick Carey, tell us about the Sydney Theatre Company's literary content. Now, this is where you... Well, what do you do there?
Well, so look, I work in marketing. I'm a content manager there. But as a dyed-in-the-wool books person, I'm always excited to see that they do a number of literary adaptions every year. We've just had the talented Mr. Ripley finish in Sydney and go on stage in Melbourne, which is very exciting. And right now on stage at the Sydney Opera House, the Drama Theatre Sydney Opera House, we have a Kate Mulvaney's adaptation of The Shirelli, which I'm sure you all know, that classic Australian swaggy tale, which is very beautiful. This is not a paid spruik, but let me tell you, it's a great show. I can't recommend it enough. And we've got a couple next year as well, actually. We've got coming up from Melbourne, from Melbourne Theatre Company, we've got a musical adaptation of My Brilliant Career, if you can believe it, which is a musical for people who love musicals, but also a musical for people who aren't so sure about musicals. It sort of crosses the aisle that way. And it's got a really powerhouse performance from Carla Gare at the centre. And we're also doing an American play, which is a sort of contemporary, semi-contemporary, semi-not contemporary adaptation of The Iliad called An Iliad.
Wow. There's so much interest in classical literature, isn't there, and revisiting it. And we keep on seeing that in fiction and now on stage as well. I mean, yeah. Obviously the Iliad's pretty good on stage.
It's pretty good. It works. And it's got David Wenham, so you know it's going to be good.
Well, look, why don't we turn to the books that you've both read for us? So, Pat Carey, you've read Chris Krause's The Four Spent the Day Together, and Nicola Heath, you've read the much-anticipated, difficult second album, version from Australian writer Madeline Gray. Let's get stuck straight into that one.
Madeline Gray is an Australian novelist and critic. She's joined us here on the bookshelf several times. In fact, she was just here in September to read Olga Tokarczuk's House of Day and Night. Her first novel, Green Dot, was published in 2023, and it was a real hit.
It was, Cassie. It was a coming-of-age story. It was a romance, sort of, and a story of messy lives. Now, Nicola, you wrote an article about that one for the ABC. Can you remind us of the shape of the novel, what you made of it?
Yes, I wrote an article about it. I think it was with sort of the title Sad Girl Novel, which is sort of a tag that's attached to these sorts of books. Green Dot is set in Sydney in a period that sort of straddles the pandemic lockdowns, and it's about a 24-year-old woman named Hira, and she is an arts graduate. I think she has 3 arts degrees, and she gets a job as a content moderator for a news organisation, not out of any professional ambition, but more out of economic necessity. So it's really soul-destroying work, like sorting through the comments, you know, the terrible comments that get attached to news articles. But she makes a connection with 40-year-old news journalist named Arthur, and they form a connection and it becomes an affair, and the book is sort of the story of that relationship. Much of it happens, you know, via social media apps and the organization's internal messaging platform. And that's the green dot. So that signifies that Arthur's online. So it was very funny and very clever, but I definitely think that it deserved its sad girl novel tag.
But now we're talking about her new novel. It's called Chosen Family. It's just out this week. It also includes a messy love story and a coming of age element, but it has a different feel, and it opens with an impassioned letter. And that letter was written in September 2023. Can you tell us about that letter? Who's writing to whom?
Yes. So the letter, which is an unsent letter, is from Eve to Nell. In it, we learn that the pair have been friends for a long time, so since high school. They have evidently become estranged. We don't know why. And then at the end of the letter, we realise that they have a daughter together, a 7-year-old daughter.
Ah, okay, so out of a love bond or what?
That's not said. We don't know.
Okay.
They were friends. They were co-parents, definitely. They have a daughter. And Nell has been absent for two years without explanation.
And that's part of the mystery that's set up, but also the whole tone of it, because we have this woman, Eve, Cassie, she's writing to Nell, the woman who she's estranged from. But even in talking about their daughter, they called their daughter Lake, and they named her after the only lesbian character in McCarthy's The Group. So they're funny. They know that they're funny. They frame their whole story as we're not like other parents. But something's happened. So this letter indicates that there's some sort of crisis in their lives. And this is how the story starts.
I see. So we're not sure whether they've been a partnered pair in having this child. They could have just been friends and one decided that they were going to have a baby, obviously, with other assistants, but they're both lesbians and there's been, we don't know.
Well, we don't know anything about Nell at this point. I mean, you would assume yes, because they have a family together. So, you know, the assumption is that they are queer and they has been a romantic relationship, but as the story progresses, you realise it's not actually, it's more as a more non-traditional model, and you find out the reasons for that.
And those reasons, wow, they're complicated, because we're flung immediately back to 2006 to their sort of origin story. And this is more than a dual narrative, it's a triple narrative. So we go back to 2006 and to their school days, and then we also meet these women in their 20s. But let's talk about what happened when they met. They're 12 years old in 2006. What was Nell like at school?
So they're at an all-girls school. Nell is from a wealthy family, so she comes from a privileged background, but she doesn't fit in, and she's she's interested in the counterculture. She just, you know, she's interested in Bob Dylan and Patti Smith, and she just wants to lock herself in a room and smoke cigarettes and be, you know, very glamorous, I guess, in that way. We see it from her perspective. That's the first perspective that we are in this world. And then Eve is very different. So, but she also doesn't fit in as well. So for these girls, school is a battleground. Like, it's an awful place. It's all about allegiances and politics, which I found very sad because they're 12.
But isn't it well drawn? So you get the awfulness of the schoolyard and the hierarchies and cruelty and people judging each other. And when Eve turns up, so she's a new girl, she's been to lots of different schools, she has a single mother who sort of rockets around the place following various blokes. And she's brash, she's clever, she's the new girl, and she sort of leaps in and Nell goes, oh, I could be friends with her.
Mm-hmm.
They do. They form an immediate connection and then they are each other's people. So they offer each other sanctuary in what is not a very safe sort of social environment.
Right. Okay. So they're best friends forever. They're going to battle through. One is wealthy, one not so much, but both lacking perhaps a little bit of stability in their home lives.
Nell's family is awful. Her parents treat her dismissively. And that's part of the cruelty of the story, really, is seeing how this 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old is treated by her family as well. So we really get to understand these characters, I think.
And then that's what draws them together. They offer each other what they don't have. And I suppose that sort of foreshadows the chosen family of the title.
I see. Okay. So one of them presumably decides to have the child, and that is Eve?
No, Eve articulates this idea of a chosen family when she's only 13 or 14. So when Eve and Nell are friends, she says, why couldn't you just have a baby with your best friend? And so this idea of finding your own people and building alternative family structures is something that Eve is committed to from quite a young age. But there's something else going on in this novel, which is that we also meet them as young women. By that point, there's been some sort of school day falling out. So then the story splits, doesn't it, Nicola? And we get to understand Eve as a young woman, and then we see what's happening with Nell as well. What sort of young woman's Eve, this brash, clever girl?
Yes, well, I think Eve, when she gets to university, she reinvents herself. But I think to understand why that's so significant, when they're in high school, Nell mysteriously, to Eve's view, dumps her. And it's such an act of cruelty. So from they're inseparable from year 7 to year 9. From year 9, for the rest of high school, Nell doesn't acknowledge that Eve exists and is party to some awful bullying. Like, Eve has no friends. Like, she says that what she learns about, you know, the way that teenage sort of social dynamics work, she learns from TV, like from Dawson's Creek. And so when she gets to university, she's got a lot riding on this. This is her chance to live a life that she has really put on hold for all of her teenage years. She's also become to accept her sexuality at this point too. So she was teased for being a lesbian when she was at high school. And I suppose because there's so much shame attached to it, she denied it to herself for a long time. By the time she gets to uni, she's accepted it. She's queer. She's ready to go. She makes some new friends and she really embraces university life. She has, I think, what could only be called a sexual awakening. So there's some really explicit sex scenes in this part. She does all the drinking, takes all the drugs. It's a really sort of exciting time for her.
It's a wild old time. And I love the way it's described. She takes us into Sydney in a way that you can sort of feel and recognise if you know the place. So it's a sexy, glittering town, and she's in and out of share houses and pubs and friendships. And again, she's making a different type of chosen family. She's finding her people with this whole new world that she's discovering in Sydney.
She does. It's the, you know, the inner west of Sydney, so there's a lot going on. It's really steeped in queer culture, and she really is a different person. At this point, this is when Eve and Nell's lives intersect again, which then puts them onto the trajectory to having a child.
Is it a love story? Is it a family story? Is it a story of co-parenting? You've got all these questions that were set up with that very first letter How did they come to have a child together? Why are they now no longer speaking to each other?
Again.
And what's driven this? Who's to blame, I guess? Because with that first letter, Eve saying, "Where are you? What have I done? Will you ever speak to me again?" And that's the sort of mystery that keeps you reading because you really are desperate to find out what's happened.
It's very effective as a device. I think Madeline Gray has structured this novel in a way that really makes it, it's very propulsive. So you want to find out what happened between these two women. I mean, the thing with their relationship is that initially Eve was attracted to Nell. And then later on, we learn that Nell is attracted to Eve and it never lines up. They can't talk about the way that they feel about each other. So even though they've been inseparable, they've been so close, I think this shame that they have experienced as children about their sexuality, it's like caused this sort of injury, this homophobia has injured them so that they can never really be open and honest about how they feel about each other. So even though it sort of remains platonic, they definitely have feelings for each other.
So it's a story about longing as well.
It is. But then their inability to really talk to each other, they're so close, but they just can't say what they really mean, is like, yeah, it's very compelling the way that she's done that. I just feel like it makes me very sad that they were treated that way, you know, in this formative period of their lives, that they can never really just be open and honest and about how they feel.
Well, and doesn't it say something that we're talking about these characters as if we know them? Because that's the reading experience, is that you are inside these characters' lives and aware of things that aren't being said and that you wished as being said, and then the other people. So they're well-realised characters.
Is it entirely successful? Is it, you know?
Look, the only thing, and I sort of wrestled with even how to express this, some of her observations and portrayals of heterosexual relationships and parenting I thought were a little cliched, and I wondered if that was revenge, really, against all the ways in which gay people and gay relationships have been stereotyped over the years. Because there were times when I was sort of reading this description of how heterosexual couples act and parents, and I thought, really? Who? How does it work like this? Surely not everybody. But I think that was also a sort of knowing thing that's in there. But for me, that was the bit that it's like, really, do we need those stereotypes? But of course, there are so many stereotypes around other lives. So I'm sure she knows what she's doing there.
There are stereotypes throughout the novel, and she plays on them sort of for humour as well sometimes, like, you know, assumed knowledge. Like, she pokes fun at the queer community, I think, just as much as she does at the heterosexual community as well. But this is a book, it's deeply embedded in queer culture, and she really does a good job of describing queer community in a way that sort of reminded me of Dylan Hardcastle's A Language of Limbs, and then also David Owen Kelly's Host City, where sort of people who were raised in communities that didn't accept them, and then they've found a group of people who did accept them and who became their family.
It's a very engaging, propulsive novel. It was a pleasure to read.
Well, that is Chosen Family by Madeline Gray. This is The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National, your What Should I Read Next guide. I'm Cassie McCullough, here with Kate Evans, as always, and with us today, ABC arts journalist Nicola Heath, and from the Sydney Theatre Company, Patrick Carey.
And now we're turning to the latest from American art critic and writer, Chris Krauss.
And her novel, I Love Dick, is often described as a cult classic, and I'm terrified that just saying that on the radio will become a meme somehow. It's a combination of critical theory, autofiction, and the story of a woman who becomes obsessed with a writer named Dick, based on the real theorist Dick Hebdiger, who was apparently appalled by the whole thing.
And this is a writer who loves a bit of border crossing. She's also written a literary biography of Kathy Acker, she of Blood and Guts in High School.
Her other novels include Aliens and Anorexia, Torpor, and Summer of Hate. But before we get to this latest and ninth book of hers, which is called The Four Spend the Day Together, Patrick Carey, give us a bit of context for her novels. Have you read a few?
I've read all of them.
Oh,
I'm a big fan. Chris Krause is a member, perhaps now these days, the most well-known member of a very loose group of writers out of America in the 80s and 90s called the New Narrative Movement. They reacted against the big grand novels of the 60s and 70s by turning the camera in on themselves and using their stories and their experiences, often queer, often marginalised, often working class experiences, as a lens to look at America, to tell stories. As a result, many of the books that come under that title of New Narrative have this element that we now all toss around very happily, autofiction, but a couple of years ago I think was like quite a highfalutin term. As you've correctly pointed out, Cassie, I Love Dick. Imagine reading it on the train. Just think about that. I Love Dick is the first of a loose sequence of novels that Krause has published sort of every 5 years or so since 1997 that deal with a central character who takes very heavily after Krause herself. What's interesting is that Krause does this thing where she changes the character's name in every book, which is quite confusing. So in I Love Dick, the character is called Chris Krause, and it's very clearly about Chris Krause. But subsequent books, she's called Sylvie. In this book that we're talking about today, she's called Kat. But the border between fiction and lived experience, autobiography, autofiction, if that's what you want to call it, is always sort of on the table for Krause and is always being troubled. The sequence of books follow this character, named diversely over the course of the last 30 or so years, deal with things as diverse as attempting to adopt a child from post-Soviet Romania, making a film in New Zealand about Simone Weil, the most recent book prior to this one, about flipping an allotment of apartments in Albuquerque to turn them into affordable housing. She wears many hats, does our Chris, and she puts them all into her books, which I enjoy thoroughly.
Incredible. Okay. Well, you are well placed to be reviewing it for us. So this new one, The Four Spent the Day Together, which once again sounds like a, you know, Enid Blyton title, tell us a bit about the structure, I guess.
Well, it's a novel in three parts, and it isn't a spoiler, I think, to talk about what happens in each of these sections, just to get a sense of it. And they're apparently disparate stories, but as Pat said, they're all connected by this character, Chris Krause's avatar, which is a woman called Kat. So the first part is about Kat's parents. It's about working class lives and then her own quite troubled childhood. The middle part is about the character of Kat's marriage, and it includes a whole lot of stories of addiction, as well as a swerve back into the building industry that I think we might talk about. And then part three is true crime-ish, in that she's spinning off from a real and an awful thing that happened, where three teenagers killed an older acquaintance, and that becomes an exploration of sort of poverty and drugs and addiction and so on. Each of these sections are tied to a different place in America.
And each of these sections begins with the description of a house.
She's really interested in housing.
She loves real estate, yeah. But this book is very much about home and what home actually is.
And I guess disruptions of home and home that isn't particularly welcoming. But if we talk about maybe the beginning of the book, I mean, how welcomed in to the story did you feel?
Well, it's interesting. As far as I can remember, there are quite a few books in this sequence, but as far as I can remember, this is the furthest back we've ever gone in Chris's life in any great detail. And I found this perhaps the most moving part of the book. It follows Kat's family moving from New York City to Milford, Connecticut. And in that place, she immediately experiences a wealth divide in an almost ludicrously explicit way, which is that a certain part of the beach is cut off to members of the poorer part of the town. I found the writing in this section really moving and really evocative and lyrical in a way that I don't necessarily associate with Krause in her previous books. She's always great at evoking place, but this, maybe because it is going so far back in her life, had a sort of dreamlike or poetic quality that I really enjoyed.
And there's quite an interesting connection to the the Madeleine Gray book that we were just talking about, because it's also a story of a clever girl at school who is then bullied horribly, and then she has to decide how to respond to it, and it's often in pretty self-destructive ways.
Absolutely. It's certainly putting a middle finger up to the man by going out and drinking and partying and talking to much older men.
And sniffing glue. And sniffing glue. Drugs.
Krauss's writing about addiction is amazing, and drug use in general, but one of the things that really sets the previous book in the sequence apart from the whole sequence is that it is told from two perspectives, that is Kat Dunlop's and also Paul Watkins, her husband's perspective, which is the first time I think that Krauss has written from another perspective in a fictive way. For a bit of context, the character Paul Watkins is, at the start of the book, a recovered drug addict, an alcohol-addicted person, who's been to prison for a litany of very minor crimes in the scheme of things, but is struggling to keep things together by the start of the book. And so she writes really amazingly about addiction, but it is a big thread in this book. And it's interesting, actually, Kate, that I hadn't really thought about how it features in that first section as sort of part of the fabric of middle America, even in the 60s.
Because this does feel like a book that is addressing what's happening in America now, even though it's a book that goes back into the 1960s. There's a sense in which she's sort of taking the temperature of America and trying to assess it. And as the book goes on, that becomes grimmer and grimmer. But there is this odd swerve halfway through the book where this writer, who is using aspects of her own life to create what she's calling fiction, then goes into something that is like a sort of self-serving argument about the way that the author has been perceived. What's going on there?
It's a part of the book that I found quite provocative, but also a little, I don't know if it fully works. In the middle of the book, we're following Kat as she tries to write what I think will become the Kathy Acker biography. Again, it's really an unusual book to talk about because we're talking about real life, we're talking about the novel, we're talking about the character's experience, but they're all sort of intermingled. But at the birth of the quote-unquote cancel culture movement, there are a couple of barbs thrown in the direction of Chris Krauss about the fact that she is a landlord, a fact that she wrote very compellingly and interestingly about in Summer of Hate, the book that precedes this one. As a result, Kat Dunlop, Chris Krauss, who knows, gets embroiled in an ongoing discourse about whether or not she should be taking part in the gentrification of a certain neighbourhood in Los Angeles. And this causes the character a lot of psychic pain.
So there's a sort of internet pylon.
An internet pylon, indeed.
Where she's being accused of being a slum landlord.
But isn't it low cost housing, isn't it? Affordable housing.
Yeah, well, it was that in the book. I don't know what happened in real life, but certainly she claimed that it was in the Summer of Hate. And based on her politics in general, I would say that that is consistent. Anyway, as Kate implied, there becomes a kind of defensive rant against cancel culture. And as a millennial, I did find it difficult because it did feel so defensive. I think I'm just trained to think that way now. But then, look, as a formalist, I asked myself the question, and I ask all of us the question as well, if this is an artist, a great artist, who's continued to successfully and intriguingly use her life as a lens to make art, should she not be using this part too?
Well, and this is a book that the more you read it, the more questions it raises, and you have to sort of try to work out where you position yourself as a reader, because it's not giving anything away, as I said earlier, to point out that the last section is sort of true crime. So both the narrator and the writer stumbles upon the story of these three teenagers who are living in poverty, who are taking meth, who are living very marginalised lives, and they meet up with an older acquaintance. They spend the day together, and that this is where the title comes from, which sounds like a sort of Enid Blyton day, but this came up in the court case. The four spent the day together, and then they lead this man off and they kill him.
And for almost no discernible reason.
And this is an exploration of those people and their lives and what happens. But it's also sort of an exploration of stumbling around trying to do the research. At one point, she puts a sign up in a laundromat, say, basically saying, meth heads wanted, come and talk to me, I'm a writer. And it's like, surprise, surprise, they didn't. And they thought she was a fed. They thought she was a narc. They didn't know what was going on. And so it's not quite true crime, but it's also not not true crime.
It's really interesting. And I think one thing that I would love to talk about is the fact that if you were just going off the marketing copy about this book, you would expect it to be In Cold Blood for 2025 or one of the Gary Indiana novels that are fully true crime. But it really isn't that. And I think it's quite misleading because the majority of the book is sort of classic Krauss in a sense.
Well, I mean, maybe that's at the heart of the problem, but I feel in this book, and that is that it sounds a little in-house for me. I'd be arriving at a party late. It seems to have a complex structure that I would spend a lot of the, you know, book half wishing I had a notepad to keep notes to stay up. It has mixed lines between real and fiction. It has a particular politic that if you're not on board with it, you feel like, you know, you're going to get cancelled. And it doesn't have a clear line through. I mean, sell it to me.
Well, I mean, I think, and this is not my reading, but I was in the same boat as you, Cassie. I thought, well, it is a bit misleading to say that this is a true crime novel. But I read a great review in Four Columns. They said what she's actually doing is a very ingenious bait and switch, which is drawing us in with our, you know, shared prurient interest in bloody murder and then switching it out to show us the real, well, not the real, but another far larger crime that's happening in America right now, which is the way that working class people have been totally denuded.
You can't have your meat if you haven't eaten your peas.
That's right.
Coming to it cold and without all that context, I think it's the first section and then the last section are the most successful. And all of the sort of the messiness with addiction and cancel culture and trying to justify her own position as a writer almost, I could have lived without some of that.
I agree with that to a certain extent. I think for me as an avid fan and a follower, reading about the disintegration of her marriage, which I don't think is a spoiler, in the central part was extremely compelling because I'm so wedded to those characters and I want to see how their lives turn out. But yes, I think the most interesting writing in this book is in the first and in the third section.
Bleak but interesting. And that's Chris Krauss's The Four Spent the Day Together, published by Scribe.
You are listening to The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National or via your podcast delivery service of choice. We are here with Nicola Heath and Pat Carey, our guests today, reviewers, and we're about to find out what books they recommend. First to you, Nicola Heath, and your incredible broad reading diet must have offered you a few gems in recent times. What have you liked recently?
Yes, well, I always like to have a go-to recommendation to offer people when they ask what they should what they should read. And so this year I have been recommending Wild Dark Shore by Charlotte McConaughey.
I have had many people recommend this to me, but I'd never remember anything. Remind me why I should read it.
I would describe it as a literary page turner. So it has a plot that makes you want to read to the end. It's also, you know, engages with some really pertinent ideas, you know, about climate change and things that we're dealing with right now. And the setting is so evocative.
The setting is the real star of that book. It's sort of Macquarie Island-esque, right?
Yes, and she went on a research trip.
Macquarie
famously.
Island being the last stop before Antarctica off the end of Australia.
A sub-Antarctic island, yes. It, in the novel, is feeling the effects of climate change, so the rising sea levels and things. And there's a seed vault on the island which is under threat, which was inspired by the flooding of the Svalbard seed vault maybe in 2017. It's also just a really good story. So I recommend that one. The other one you talked about recently on the show, which is The Transformations by Andrew Pipos.
Ah, yes.
I, like you, Cassie, I think really enjoyed it. I loved the world of media, newspapers that he evoked, you know, for sort of from the last decade. And I thought it was a really subtle and assured kind of creation of a man's interior life and his relationships. And I found the ending very moving as
yes.
well.
Yes.
Anything else, Nicola? Do you only read fiction?
No. So I've brought in a beautiful edition of a book that I found at a indie bookshop in Brisbane while I was browsing, which is a lovely way to come across books, I find. This is a memoir called The Salt Stones by Helen Wybrow. I love an outdoorsy memoir, I think perhaps because I spend so much time inside looking at a computer screen. So the subtitle of this one is The Seasons of a Shepherd's Life. So I'm sort of getting in touch with my inner shepherd, but it's about slowing down. It's about reconnecting with the seasons and traditional knowledge. It's set in a really beautiful part of America, which I've never been to, in Vermont. I grew up on a farm, so some of it's very familiar to me, like the way that looking after sheep and all the rest of it, but it's also so different because they have such long, cold winters, and it's very interesting. And Helen Wybrow, the author, she's a literary editor and she is an author as well. So she writes very poetically about the landscape and engages in, you know, really quite a philosophical way with some like big ideas, especially around climate change.
Wow. It makes me think of James Rebank's work, The Shepherd's Life.
And absolutely.
Idea of being crofted yourself to the land.
And she refers to that novel, right. yeah, quite a lot. Definitely the idea of being crofted, yes. And I do love James Rebank's, so... Yeah.
What about you, Patrick Carey? What have you read lately that you're happy to recommend?
Oh, gosh, so many things, but I've whittled my list down for you. The first one, and I can't really claim rediscovery of this forgotten text because the New York Review of Books Classics did it, but it is a it's a fictional romance of the archive called My Death by Lisa Tuttle. So when Kate and I were discussing it off air, I described it as AS by its possession, but much shorter and with actual supernatural elements rather than metaphorical ones. So if that sounds like you...
It sounds like me.
Oh, it's wonderful.
I love AS by it.
And a brief summary is it follows a writer who's lost the muse after a recent bereavement, who finds a new muse in the form of a mysterious early 20th century artist that she decides to write the biography of. And so she goes to seek this woman out, and then all sorts of Bergman-y kind of mysterious things start to happen to them. It's really good, but it's about 90 pages, so you can read it in a day. We love that.
Wow, with supernatural shenanigans.
Indeed. And also lovely writing about art. Next, I, like so many people, have done the thing that I always loathe doing, which is finding out a writer's passed away and then going, oh God, I've got to read everything that they've done now instead of while they were alive. So when the great Edmund White passed away this year, I was immediately reminded that I haven't read that many of his books. So I picked up The Married Man, which is, it comes just after the completion of his own autofictional trilogy, which finishes with the Farewell Symphony and deals with elements from his own life. It follows the sort of love story and pseudo-marriage of a couple, one being an American writer and one being a French architect who, at the beginning of the novel, is married to a woman. If it sounds like a sexy romp, it starts off that way, but it is set during the AIDS crisis and it becomes one of the most confronting stories about caring for a sick person that I've read ever. And it's a really, really beautiful book. I think it's one of the ones that everyone should read, quote unquote.
Okay, that's The Married Man by Edmund White. And what else?
The final one that I want to recommend, because it's just so bizarre and hilarious, is A Far Cry from Kensington by Muriel Spark. And she is a writer that continues to surprise me. I think because she has this reputation of writing balmy, sort of mannered social comedies, 1960s ladies wandering around. But there's always this darkness that swims through her books, like a sort of shark or something that you don't see coming, but it just grabs you by the leg. And A Far Cry from Kensington, which is set in the publishing world of the 50s and 60s in London, has this darkness. And it's just so strange. She's a writer that sort of escapes description, I think. But I love her. It's hilarious. It's bizarre. And I think everyone should read it.
Hilarious and bizarre. A Far Cry from Kensington by Muriel Spark.
Hey, Patrick, Nicola, thanks so much. Great to have you both.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a joy.
Nicola Heath is an ABC arts journalist who specialises in books. And Patrick Carey is a writer and content maker who works at the Sydney Theatre Company.
That's it for this week's edition of The Bookshelf.
And I'll be away next time, Cassie, so what books do you have lined up?
Well, Jonathan Green will be joining me and we are talking about Thomas Pynchon's Shadow Ticket, which is very much anticipated by his fans. Does it live up to their expectations? Also, Olivia Lang's The Silver Book, a fascinating trip into the world of filmmaking, Venice, Italian cinema, great stuff. And someone called Jeanette Winterson won Aladdin Two Lamps, which revisits the 1001 Nights. And I'm very surprised, Kate, that you've opted to go away when that book has come up on our calendar.
Well, that just means that it's a book I'm going to have to read over summer. It sounds like a really terrific collection of books. So that's next time on The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. We'll see you then. Well, I will, with Jonathan. But Kate will see you the next time.
Week after.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.